With me is Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, former professor of American history at the UW Oshkosh, vice president of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation at Monticello in Virginia, and professor of history at the University of Virginia. And he's the author of, among other things, The Men Who Lost America, published in 2013 by Yale University Press. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much, Norman. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's start and end with the big picture. The year 1775, let's say, for starters. What was the extent of the British Empire?
Well, the phrase, the empire upon which the sun never set, that has already been coined before the American Revolution by a man called Lord George Macartney. The empire had grown considerably in the decade before the revolution, thanks to what you in America call the French and Indian War, and what in Britain is known as the Seven Years' War, in which Britain added Canada to its empire, much of the northern west states, what are now states, including Wisconsin, and Bengal in India, which represented a considerable enlargement of the British footprint in India. And in many ways, the great problem of that success was how to administer such a far-flung empire, how to pay for it, and how to defend it. And it was really the policies that Britain pursued to deal with those issues that led to the outbreak of the American Revolution.
There were actually, let's see, I suppose if you count Canada, more like 16 colonies in the New World that belonged to Britain at that time, because you had East and West Florida too, right, briefly?
Well, by 1776, there were actually 26 British colonies in the Americas, because you had East and West Florida, but you also had all the British Caribbean islands like Jamaica and St. Kitts. And my first book, which I wrote while I was in Wisconsin, was called An Empire Divided, the American Revolution and the British Caribbean. And it's about why these other colonies did not rebel.
What were the grievances then? I mean, of course, we are familiar with some of them from the history books that we all grew up with. But what were the grievances in the American colonies, those 13 colonies, by 1775?
Well, the main one was indeed no taxation without representation. The taxes themselves were very low and would have made very little impression on the British debt. And that was Britain's major problem, that it was hugely in debt following the French and Indian War. Sometimes the debt alone cost over 50% of taxes just to service the interest on the debt. But it was raising the taxes directly from Britain, which was the real issue. The colonies had always taxed themselves, and they'd also developed their own constitutions. And they were used to a large amount of autonomy and self-government. And the efforts of British administrators to centralize the colonies, to have more direct administration, but especially to tax them directly, which began with the Stamp Act tax in 1765, that is really more than any other factor what helped to be the catalyst for the American Revolution.
What were the Americans getting for those taxes?
Well, actually, a considerable amount, and that was the argument of Britain, that Britain was paying for the administration, the defense of the colonies. They were planning to keep 10,000 soldiers to help protect the frontiers, and they felt that the colonists should share in the cost of protection. But during the previous war, they'd found it very difficult to get colonial assemblies to contribute and to contribute in equal amounts. So some colonies were quite generous, but others didn't pay at all. And so they saw this as in some ways more equitable.
Was there a pervasive attitude in Britain among administrators in particular and in the military that Americans, although British citizens, were somehow second-class citizens?
Well, I think you always get, in any imperial situation, a certain amount of arrogance and the assumption that colonies existed for the benefit of the mother country. So there was always that underlying hubris and condescension that was, of course, always resented by the colonists. It's perhaps best expressed by Benjamin Franklin, who spent a great deal of the period before the war in London. And he said every sort of tavern keeper, an ordinary person, thinks themselves somehow the superior of anyone in America.
At what point did this attitude of the Americans, then this, we'll call it a pre-revolutionary attitude, at what point did that attract the attention of George III?
Actually, quite late on. George III was blamed in the Declaration of Independence personally for instigating the policies that led to the American Revolution. But in many ways, he left most of the policymaking to his ministers, who were elected in Parliament, and he largely deferred to their judgment. There are even instances where he moderated the policies towards America, but it was the Boston Tea Party that really changed his attitude, and from that moment he became the leading war hawk. By the middle of the war, he was much more insistent on pursuing the war than many of his ministers, and he refused to negotiate with opposition leaders who started to conclude that Britain should just make peace with America.
Make peace with America by rolling back some of these policies?
Yes. In fact, even the Prime Minister by the middle of the war, Lord North, in 1778, he sent out to America something called the Carlisle Peace Commission, and he offered essentially to withdraw all of the policies that had been passed since the French and Indian War, and just to have token British government. The colonies would tax themselves. The Congress could continue in existence, even though the British had refused to even acknowledge its existence. They simply called it an illegal assembly for the first few years of the war. And it really added up to token British authority. But by that point, the former colonists were intent upon independence and were not willing to negotiate, although they were worried by these overtures because they were well aware that there was a proportion of opinion that supported the British and many others who were neutral. The revolution, like all revolutions, was also a civil war. 19,000 Americans fought for the British, and so there was real concern that if Britain offered terms, it might persuade some people to give up. And, of course, it was always a fluid situation, people changing from one side to another. That continued even after major victories like Saratoga.
Well, witness most spectacularly, of course, Benedict Arnold.
Absolutely. And that was after Saratoga. Indeed, he was one of the real heroes of the Battle of Saratoga and regarded really as the greatest American general after Washington by the British. So it was a huge coup when they won him over to their side.
What kind of division of opinion was there back in London in terms of the popular attitude and also in government?
It was initially quite popular to coerce America, but as war started to look more likely, opinion really began to split. And in 1775, with the outbreak of war, there were the largest number of petitions to Parliament that had been received during any war or indeed on any issue. There were towns in England that petitioned Parliament against the war, which had never petitioned Parliament previously. And so there was a strong anti-war element, and they were represented in Parliament by some of the great parliamentarians of all time, people like Edmund Burke, Charles James Fox, William Pitt the Elder, who died making a speech against the war. And he was succeeded by his son, who was only in his early 20s, William Pitt the Younger, who later became Britain's youngest prime minister, of whom Edmund Burke said he's not just a chip off the old block, he is the old block. These were all opponents of the war.
And among these opponents, did that include anyone in the military? When you think back just 15 years into the 1750s, early 1760s, these people in the military, British and American-British, were both fighting the same enemy in America, namely the French and their Indian allies.
It did include people in the military. Rather extraordinarily, William Howe, who was the commander-in-chief for the first half of the war, he had actually been opposed to the policies that led to the American Revolution, and he'd promised his constituents in an election of 1774 that he would never serve in America. John Burgoyne, after his defeat at the Battle of Saratoga, he went into opposition. Many of the senior commanders were also members of Parliament, which is not allowed today. There was a considerable, in fact, military presence in Parliament, including the Navy, and ultimately they voted disproportionately against the war. But that didn't happen until after Yorktown. But it's well worth remembering that they could have continued the war after Yorktown. They still had Canada, New York, Charleston and South Carolina, East Florida, Savannah. They could have continued to fight, but what really ended it was that Parliament was no longer willing to fund the war and to support the government.
Yes, cutting off the funding is a very effective political tool, isn't it?
It is.
Lord North, then, he was Prime Minister. What kind of power did he have?
It's quite considerable, especially if supported by the King. He was the Prime Minister. He had to have support in Parliament and to be able to command majorities. So the way a Prime Minister was chosen was someone who had both the support of the King and the support of the majority of the House of Commons. He's known today as the worst Prime Minister in British history because of the loss of America. But he was actually very able, especially given the brilliance of the opposition against him. He often deflected them in debate. He could give a two-hour speech without notes. And he helped organize the financing of the war. I mean, Britain never went bankrupt, whereas the French, who was supposedly helped in the American victory, they went bankrupt as a result of this war.
I've heard it said sometimes that Benjamin Franklin was kind of almost single-handedly responsible for bankrupting the French government.
Well, there's a lot of truth in it, and it led directly to the French Revolution. Although the French were always primarily concerned with the Caribbean colonies more than helping the American colonies, which is why John Adams was so frustrated with them.
How important was that set of 13 colonies to this vast British Empire? What were their priorities in terms of their colonies?
They were regarded as very important. And the West Indies had actually brought in more money for a long time, but there was general recognition of the huge potential of America. Indeed, people were writing on both sides of the Atlantic, but most famously Franklin, that the seat of the British government would ultimately be in America. They even imagined the monarchy moving to America. And so there was awareness of its importance. Indeed, George III, more than any of the other nine characters in my book, he really articulated better than any of them what he saw as the stakes in this war, and he believed that Britain would cease to be a major power without control of America.
Was there some concern among the British that if they were too conciliatory, even after the war broke out, that it would be seen as a sign of weakness?
It was, and that was George III's argument after the Boston Tea Party. You know, he said that they will be lions if we are sheep. You know, that the time had come to make a demonstration of strength.
We're going to look more closely at some of the men who lost America when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy. He's the author of, among other things, the book The Men Who Lost America. It's a set of 10 cameo portraits, very detailed cameo portraits, of military and political leaders who were influential in losing the American colonies leading up to and during the American Revolution. We've looked at some of the political leadership, George III and the Prime Minister, Lord North. And now let's take it to the sea and the battlefield and look at some of those individuals. A remarkable set of brothers are part of these sets of cameos.
Yes, William Howe and his brother, the Admiral Lord Richard Howe, they respectively commanded the Army and the Navy for the first half of the war. It, of course, sounds very nepotistic, as you might expect from a very aristocratic country. But William Howe was chosen over 106 more senior generals to command in America. He'd been a hero there during the French and Indian War. He'd been very close to James Wolfe, who's still regarded as one of Britain's leading army heroes and was responsible for the conquest of Quebec, which led to the fall of Canada to the British. And Howe was present, and indeed after Wolfe was killed, Howe helped pursue the victory. And he was chosen because he was an expert in what was called light infantry, which I suppose have some similarity to modern-day commandos. These would not be people who walked in line and made good targets for people standing behind trees. Instead, they were meant to be very flexible, to be able to break out into small groups, to be very athletic, America, and to be good at what was sometimes called Indian warfare or ambush warfare, that the British were aware would be fought in America. They knew they couldn't just pursue standard European tactics. And Howe was the great expert in that. And the reason his brother served as head of the Navy was because he argued that he must have his brother in order that they could coordinate the two forces very effectively. And what is interesting about Lord Richard Howe is he later became one of Britain's leading naval heroes during the French Revolutionary Wars. And it's a good example of the slim line between success and failure, that people who failed in one instance were highly successful in a different context. And Richard Howe was really one of the architects of what today we call amphibious warfare. That's landing troops on beaches, and the bow of the ship goes forward, and the like a gangplank, and the soldiers run off. Very much like the kind of tactics of D-Day. And these two managed to get over 20,000 troops onto Staten Island in late August of 1776 and 12 cannon, all within a few hours. They were highly effective, and William Howe won all the battles in which he commanded against George Washington. And those were some of the largest battles of the American Revolution.
And that raises an interesting question. I heard Gore Vidal say years ago that George Washington was not a great general, but he was a great leader. Where would you stand on that?
Yeah, I have a lot of admiration for Washington and think he was a key to victory. It is true that there's division about his generalship, but you have to remember that he was dealing with civilians for much of the early years of the war. And he was also forced politically to protect places like New York, where he essentially knew he couldn't win. But just making a show of resistance was very important psychologically and in terms of morale. And I think his great strength was actually to combine both a gift from the military, which he really demonstrated at Trenton and the crossing of the Delaware, but also a master politician. I mean, it's interesting that several people were considered as alternatives to Washington, and in the early years of the war, when it didn't seem as though the Patriots were winning, there were even attempts to replace him, and they would have all been disastrous. And one of the people considered was a former British Army officer called Charles Lee, whose name among the Native Americans was Boiling Water Lee. And there's no way someone like that could have worked with Congress.
How did the Howe brothers fail then? The general won every battle that he fought with George Washington, and you have a Navy commander, an admiral, who has great facility with the kind of warfare that the Revolution required.
Well, the problem for them was really the problem for all of these generals and those who commanded in America, that they believed that the majority of Americans would support them. That's what they'd been told. The government insisted on that until almost the entire end. And they had what I describe as an army of conquest, but not an army of occupation. The generals took all of the American cities at some point during the war. But as the Howes demonstrate, following success, the moment they started to spread their forces and to occupy territory, they immediately began to fail. And the great example was the winter of 1776-7, the famous winter in which Washington crossed the Delaware. When Howe had felt confident enough, he'd chased Washington out of New York, They were so confident, they even used hunting horns to pursue retreating Connecticut militia and others out of New York. And he'd expanded across about a half of New Jersey, what were called cantons, encampments. The last one was Trenton, just on the banks of the Delaware River. And, of course, Washington fought a rearguard action and took Howe entirely by surprise. No one expected an attack over Christmas. Usually military campaigning ended during the winter season because of the problems of feeding an army. But what is less known is that Howe actually lost more men later that winter, and it was not because of Washington's daring, but when his soldiers went out on foraging campaigns to get food, they were picked off by militia. And that was the problem all along. They really didn't have the ground support.
You mentioned General Burgoyne at Saratoga in 1777, a loss so notable that even Mozart writes about it in one of his letters. Was he too timid or too aggressive? Was that his? Which was his failing?
Well, it's interesting because Howe's always been called too timid and Burgoyne too aggressive. And it really is a case that whichever method you chose, you could not win. And in some ways, the argument of this book is counterintuitive, that actually the British in many ways were likely to fail. And Burgoyne had the kind of bravery, the daring that George III and the Minister for War in England, Lord George Germain, had really been looking for. He was a risk taker. He famously was a great gambler in his sort of social life. And he had essentially told the government that he could march down from Canada, take Fort Ticonderoga, and get to New York and pretty well end the revolution. The point about Burgoyne, like so many of the 10 individuals in this book, is that he'd been a star before the war. He had been famous for the defense of Portugal against Spain. He read all the military literature in French, which was really regarded as the best military literature at the time. He gave considerable thought to how you trained officers, and he was one of the first to argue that ordinary soldiers should be well treated. He'd also toured the battlefields of Europe and had written an assessment of the different armies of Europe, and yet, of course, he still failed. And he said afterwards, you know, he'd come from Canada and he'd outnumbered the Americans 2-1, but by the time he got to Saratoga, he was outnumbered 4-1. He said, by far from being poor quality troops, they were as good as anyone's in Europe. And he also observed that Britain just didn't have the necessary support in America, and that was the great lesson for him.
You mentioned Lord George Germain in being a proponent of General Burgoyne. What was his failing in losing America?
Well, he's the civilian who is often most blamed for the British defeat, even though most modern readers and even graduate students in history have likely not heard of him. But he was the man, the minister most responsible for waging the war in America. And in actual fact, his strategy was the one that most historians argue could possibly have succeeded, if indeed any strategy could have succeeded. But he argued in favor of a very quick victory and a massive reinforcement of troops to really overwhelm the opposition, which is, sounds very like the Colin Powell doctrine, and only negotiating after that victory had been won. He argued negotiations beforehand wouldn't work and would just be seen as a sign of weakness. You had to negotiate from a position of strength. And he managed to send out 35,000 men from across Europe. About a third of the British Army was coming from Germany because they were, in many ways, soldiers of fortune, although some people just like to call them auxiliaries. British troops from Ireland, where about a third of the British Army was kept during peacetime just to maintain order in Ireland, and others from England. It required all of Britain's merchant navy to transport these people across the ocean. And he was doing this with a staff of 25 people.
It's remarkable.
In which every order was handwritten, including all orders for every item of supplies and food. They were often just coming from small farms. I mean, none of this was industrially manufactured. And he managed to give the generals, both in Canada and New York, more troops than they'd requested. And his argument was that they should link up and essentially destroy Washington's army. And Howe came very close at the Battle of Brooklyn. He essentially had Washington pinned with a high proportion of the Continental Army. But there was a freak gale. And Washington was successfully ferried across by fishermen from Marblehead back to Manhattan and managed to escape. But it is interesting to speculate what would have happened if he'd been captured and most of the Continental Army at Brooklyn. And that was what Germain had in mind. It was not a bad tactic.
His main weakness, bad luck.
His main weakness was he kept insisting that the majority of Americans supported Britain. And at some point, it became clear that that just wasn't true.
Was there a favorite scapegoat among these men who lost America?
Well, Germain was one of them, and essentially the military blamed the politicians, and the politicians blamed the military.
Where did Sir Henry Clinton come into that?
So Clinton was the commander-in-chief for the second half of the war, and there's only ever been one biography of him. And that this is true. Germain has had very few biographies, and they've not nearly been as well written about as, say, the Confederate leadership during the Civil War. And the one biography of Clinton, which is very good in many ways, but essentially it's a psychological history. And it argues that he was incredibly neurotic and incapable of making decisions and hesitant. But I always say it's like the old psychiatrist joke. Good news is that you are anxious. The bad news is you have much to be anxious about. He took over command in the middle of the war, when he was expected to win with fewer troops than the Howe brothers, and yet when Britain was fighting a world war, first with France, then Spain, and then also with Holland, and all of Europe aligned against it. It's the only time other than 1940 where Britain really was standing alone. And far from being incapable, he was the most cerebral of all of the commanders and the best read in military literature, highly experienced, having served in Germany during the Seven Years' War. And he also really recognized the key factors that would lead to Britain's defeat. And this was what paralyzed him and made him so distraught. And he even broke out crying in front of a young captain at the beginning of his command. He tried to resign from the outset, and he said, I'd rather be that sentry than in my position. And he essentially recognized that the British were very vulnerable at sea if there was ever a case of a superior French navy off the coast of America, which happened several times before Yorktown. And he said that Britain also needed to, what he called, win the hearts and minds of the Americans. And he argued that the army was not winning the hearts and minds, and therefore would inevitably be defeated.
There's one name above all associated with the British loss of the Revolutionary War in America. We'll look at him and two other players as well, men who lost America. We continue right after this on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy. He's the author of The Men Who Lost America, a story of some 10 people who are prominent in the British loss of the American colonies during the Revolution. The name most associated with losing the Revolution, at least on this part of the Atlantic, would be Charles Earl Cornwallis, who surrendered to Washington and, I suppose, the French at Yorktown. What does he have to answer to?
So Cornwallis was the most aristocratic of the commanders, and he's parodied in the film by Mel Gibson, The Patriot, where he's shown as more concerned about his uniform and his dogs than winning the war. And that's one of the problems of all of these leaders. They've often been treated as caricatures, not only in America, but also in Britain, especially in the popular media, which tells you a lot about this sort of folk view of historical events, but also even in some of the academic literature. But Cornwallis, far from being concerned with sartorial elegance and status, was actually the opposite. He was in many ways the least pompous of all of these commanders. He was very much a professional soldier in the modern sense. He'd been in the military, again, like most of these men, since his early teens. And at Ramsay's Mill in North Carolina, he burnt all his baggage and even his tents, slept out in the open with his soldiers, and was determined to pursue Nathanael Greene. Cornwallis went on to be a highly successful general and political administrator in both Ireland and in India. In India, he would later be responsible for helping to conquer much of southern India. And he was twice governor general there. In Ireland, he put down one of the greatest of all Irish rebellions, the Rebellion of 1798. He again illustrates that these people could be successful in other contexts.
Well, how did he end up getting bottled up in Yorktown?
Well, I mean, he and Clinton blamed each other. He said Clinton had promised him reinforcements and hadn't been clear about instructions. In fact, both of them should have blamed the Navy. They were assured by the government that they would have British naval superiority off the coast of Yorktown. If that had happened, Cornwallis couldn't have been bottled up. He could have just got on ships and gone back to New York or down to Charleston, where he'd come from. Instead, a huge French navy appeared quite unexpectedly, and essentially he was checkmate.
It must have been, what shall we say, a heart-sinking moment when he saw the flags atop those ships coming over the horizon?
It must have been. And indeed, some people have argued he should have fought for longer, but he could see that it was an impossible situation. And he was quite a humane person and would simply not have wasted life fighting a futile battle.
How did the French fleet, was it Admiral de Grasse?
Yes.
Commanding the French fleet, a large fleet, as you said. How did they know to go to Yorktown, and why was the British fleet not there first?
Well, much of it can be attributed to de Grasse, who probably should be more of a hero in America than Lafayette, because de Grasse exceeded his orders. He arrived in the Caribbean with a huge fleet, but he was meant to split the fleet and send part of it back to France as a convoy with their merchant shipping. Instead, he kept his fleet together. He used Spanish ships to protect the French islands like Guadeloupe and Martinique. And he appeared with this unexpectedly large fleet off Yorktown. Now, the reason he knew to go to Yorktown is he stopped at Saint-Domingue, what is now Haiti, and he took on Virginia pilots, people who knew the Chesapeake Bay, and he'd obviously had warning. Washington wanted him to go to New York. Washington believed New York would be the mother of all battles, but it was his own decision to go to Virginia and essentially to defeat a smaller British force. The main British force was under Henry Clinton in New York.
So Cornwallis, I gather, was highly successful in sort of ranging through the southern colonies up to that point?
He had been, yes. I mean, it's remarkable that he marched up to Virginia and took Virginia totally by surprise, to the point that he very nearly captured Thomas Jefferson. His troops got to Monticello. There was a battle in Charlottesville. And Virginia was in complete disarray. His great achievement was defeating the Continental Army in the South at the Battle of Camden in 1780. And it looked for a moment as if the tide of war might change in Britain's favor.
This is 1781 by now, and the war has gone on for probably, 6 years?
Mm-hmm.
And getting back to the Caribbean and the British Navy versus the French Navy, where was the failing there? You have two more figures here associated with the British Navy.
That's right. Sir George Rodney and the Earl of Sandwich. Ultimately, it was a naval failure. And there should have been a superior British fleet. Sir George Rodney was commanding in the Caribbean, and he was meant to pursue de Grasse to Virginia, which he failed to do. The interesting thing about Rodney is he was the most successful of all 10 people in the book, and yet in many ways he should suffer some of the most blame by his failure to pursue de Grasse. But he captured or killed during the war three enemy admirals of three different European fleets, France, Spain, and Holland. So he was the one person in the book to actually emerge with his reputation enhanced. And the Earl of Sandwich was the man most responsible for the Navy. Other than Germain, he's the person people blame the most, because Britain was supposed to have what was known at the time as a two-power navy that could defeat France and Spain combined. The whole strength of the British was the size of their navy. This is what allowed them to have a large empire for such a small island with a relatively small army. But Sandwich is unfairly blamed. He had been administering the Navy before some of the other cabinet members were even born. And he had argued, even before Lexington and Concord, that Britain should mobilize its entire fleet. He said every time we fight a war, that the Navy is unprepared and it needs to, the mobilization needs to start earlier. And the government, in fact, vetoed him and, in fact, reduced funding for the Navy. And so Sandwich was only able to begin building up the Navy in the middle of the war. But the last section of this book begins with the word victory, which is perhaps surprising for a book about the American Revolution. But the fact is that Sandwich was really the architect of, along with Rodney, who commanded, of one of the great British naval victories against the French. It's known as the Battle of the Saints. It was fought in the Caribbean a few months after the Battle of Yorktown. If it had been a few months before the Battle of Yorktown, that again could have made a huge difference in terms of the outcome of the war. And it was the biggest victory, essentially, before the victory of Trafalgar. It would be the subject of a national holiday each year in Britain. And it really allowed the British to make terms and to end this war without losing the rest of their empire and having saved face.
One thing that you touched on earlier, Andrew, was the real difficulty of communicating, especially between Britain and the British forces in America in the 1770s and early 80s, and how long it took to get word from one place to the other.
Well, communications was a major problem, not least because these ships were so subject to weather and to delays. I mean, supposedly you could make you know, a quick crossing, but to actually exchange messages was often a lengthy process. It could be a matter of months, by which time the military situation had completely changed. Interestingly, Lord George Germain recognized that and argued that it was best to leave as much discretion as possible for the commanders because they were on site and only they could really know the situation.
My high school history teacher said that the British did not lose the war, they just stopped fighting. What would be your overall appraisal then of how Britain moved forward after the surrender at Yorktown? And there was an official treaty a couple of years later, wasn't there?
Yes. The Peace of Paris in 1783. And in fact, they went on, of course, to enlarge their empire. By the time George III died, and he didn't die until 1820, and he was one of the last living, along with Jefferson and John Adams, of the sort of leaders on either side of the American Revolution. But by the time he died, the British Empire was larger than it had been in 1776, particularly because Britain by that point had conquered much of India. It represented about a sixth of the world's global population. So it was the largest empire on earth at any time in history, although it actually was larger in the 1930s, ironically, just before the Second World War, than at any other period of its own history.
And so what were relations between the former colonies and Britain like from 1783 until, let's say, that formative year of 1812?
Well, the British thought that the United States would break up and that individual states would start to renegotiate to return to be part of the British Empire. Jefferson was very worried that the British would have a neo-colonial influence over America, and that's a modern term, but essentially that it would still dominate America. And it was one of the reasons for his hatred of Hamilton, because Hamilton actually thought that it was good to trade with the British, that they were the obvious best trading partners, and he preferred the British to the French. And so Britain did remain immensely influential, not just politically, but culturally as well. And people read more British books than American books. They liked to imitate British furniture and British manners well into the 19th century. But there was still a lot of outstanding issues between the British and Americans that really are highlighted by the War of 1812. Henry Clinton, interestingly, wrote a huge memoir of the American Revolution. He was the only one to do so. And he was very well aware in his retirement that everyone was bored of the subject and not interested. But he said, the British will have to think about America because they're going to be fighting another war with it. And the country is going to continue to expand. He even believed it would expand into South America.
And, of course, the British also had something else to think about. They were at war with France for most of that time.
That's right. The British were always ultimately more concerned with Europe and the balance of power in Europe. And they never wanted France or Spain or any of the other countries to dominate Europe. And so it was critical for them to always be most focused on Europe. I mean, even at the height of their empire, the majority of their trade was with Europe.
So, overview. We started with an overview, and if we end with an overview, Britain in 1783, thoughts about America and what they might have done differently.
Well, the British themselves blamed the leadership, which is very popular in any time in history. You need scapegoats. And they never really accepted that this was a war that should never have been fought, that they'd failed to win the Battle of Hearts and Minds. They failed to persuade Americans of their case. It made much more sense that the British had been intent on tyranny than that the Patriots were the ones who were really trying a coup. And were themselves tyrannical, which was what the British argued. So that, you know, they just didn't make the best case.
Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure for me as well.
He's the author of, among other things, The Men Who Lost America, published in 2013 by Yale University Press, and he was speaking to us from Thomas Jefferson's home, Monticello. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.